Hello, everybody, and welcome to Grey History. I'm your host, Will Clark, and this is episode 40, The September Massacres, Part 2. In the last episode, we witnessed the bloody murder of hundreds of prisoners in the nation's capital. Fueled by a mixture of fear, panic, and an all-consuming fixation on plots and conspiracies, a small group of assailants slaughtered roughly half of the prisoners of Paris. In this episode, we're going to examine the role that various individuals, factions, and institutions played in these massacres. Who encouraged them? Who instigated them? Who tried to bring them to an end? And who deliberately prolonged their occurrence? Nothing about the September massacres is clear-cut, pardon the pun, and this episode will be absolutely swimming in grey history. We'll commence our analysis with the role of the Commune, followed by the leading revolutionary figures of Robespierre, Marat, and Danton. We'll then shift to the Assembly and the disputed actions of the Girondin faction. There's plenty to cover, and there's no shortage of controversy. But before we get into it, just a quick reminder that I desperately need your help to keep Grey History going. I've left my job, I've put my career on hold, and I'm throwing everything I can into bringing you more Grey History more often. But it won't be sustainable without your support. So please, if you like Grey History, if you're enjoying Grey History, if you want more Grey History, I need your help. Please continue to tell people about the show, and if you can, please support the show on Patreon or by using the links in the show notes or on the website to make a one-off donation. A huge thank you to everyone who has been helping to support the show in various ways, particularly since I've announced throwing caution to the wind and trialing full-time production. As always, a warm welcome to the new Patreon sponsors of the show, the virtuous citizen Asher and the true revolutionary Dana. Also, a big thank you to Charles for increasing his pledge, as well as his messages of support over the last couple of years. Charles now joins Jeffrey, Cynthia, George, Brady, Tim, and Mark as the fabulous champions of the people. Of course, a special call out to the extra generous heroes of the revolution, Brian, Jinx, Eric, and Christy. As always, thank you for the support of all the patrons of the show, who are quite literally keeping Grey History running. Anyway, that's enough from me, so let's jump into it. Welcome to Grey History. Episode 40, The September Massacres. Part 2. In the aftermath of the September Massacres, the increasingly influential Georges Danton remarked that the Parisians had put a river of blood between themselves and their enemies. While the roughly 1,200 corpses perhaps did not create a literal river, I would suggest that a similar metaphor was perhaps even more fitting. As the violent and turbulent days of the September massacres passed, the Parisians, the French, indeed the revolution as a whole, had crossed the Rubicon. The bloodiest of all the popular journées of the entire revolution, the consequences of this event are as numerous as the corpses. But before we talk about how this river of blood changed the character, the trajectory, the dynamics of the revolution, we should first spend the time to answer some of the great unanswered questions from the last episode. Who committed these murders? Who condoned the killings? Why did the authorities of the Commune and the Assembly fail to prevent the deaths? And why did they fail to halt them once the massacres had commenced? Perhaps most importantly, was this bloodletting spontaneous? Or was it planned? Was the mass slaughter of suspected royalist conspirators itself a conspiracy? One committed by revolutionaries in an attempt to secure the revolution which the prisoners supposedly sought to overturn. It's these key questions that we'll explore this episode. And get ready, because we're about to wade through some incredibly contentious and quite murky grey history. The killings which consumed Paris commenced on the 2nd of September 1792, as rumours swirled that the Prussian army had not only taken the fortress of Verdun, but was in fact less than 30 miles from the capital. Over 4 days, approximately 1,200 were killed at more than half a dozen prisons. With a combination of makeshift trials and simple execution squads dispensing the people's justice. So, given the deaths of more than 1,000 prisoners, how many assailants assaulted the prisons between the 2nd and 6th of September? Furthermore, who were these men who claimed to be protecting the revolution from sinister plotters and seditious priests? It might come as a surprise that the number of perpetrators was actually quite small. In fact, astonishingly small. The rough consensus is that, in total, the assailants numbered as few as 300. These perpetrators were composed primarily of Federe volunteers from the provinces, Parisian National Guardsmen, and finally, members of the city's radical sans-culottes. As discussed previously, this category spanned a wide range of people, and we have records of assailants being everything from masons to artisans to apprentice hairdressers. Certainly someone I wouldn't want cutting my hair. Now, some of you may think to yourself that in a city of perhaps 700,000 people, 300 assailants seems ridiculously small. And in fact, some contemporaries suggest the number to be perhaps fewer than 200. Surely a number that would be easy to stop, should the authorities have wished to do so. Others might be thinking that I just said the perpetrators were Federes, radical guardsmen, and revolutionary sans-culottes, the very same constituencies which conducted the insurrection of 10 August and supported the existence and the power of the new Paris Commune. Both of these observations leads to the same obvious question. To what extent, if any, was the revolutionary commune involved in this atrocity? Was the new municipal government complicit in the killings of the very people that were in the care of the state? To use a fitting, although completely irrelevant analogy, did the farmer let the fox into the henhouse? Before we go any further, we need to step back and set up some markers of the historical interpretations of the events of September. At a high level, there are two broad schools of thought that historians generally find themselves belonging to when discussing these events. The first is that the September massacres were spontaneous, that they were not planned, that they were not orchestrated, that they were not devised by some revolutionary extremists who were determined to do whatever it took to save the revolution from its numerous foes. The massacres erupted naturally due to unique circumstances posed by the foreign invasion, material hardships, and of course, a climate of fear and conspiracy. On the other side of this debate, there is a vocal minority of historians who think the exact opposite, that this event was planned, that it was orchestrated, that certain revolutionaries, including some prominent revolutionary leaders, actively carried out what amounts to state-sponsored murder. We're going to briefly unpack these two competing interpretations before we get into the detail, because it will help to understand the debates surrounding the roles and responsibilities of particular institutions, factions, and individuals. In the camp that considers these events to be spontaneous are several respected historians, including historian Timothy Tackett. Tackett has conducted extensive research on the massacres and is firm in his view that the authorities did not directly initiate the murders. Instead, Tackett sees a whole host of factors combining together to create the conditions required for such bloodshed. In finishing his analysis on the massacres, Tackett details the long list of contributing elements. The obsession with prison conspiracy, the desire for revenge, the fear of the advancing Prussians, the ambiguity over who was in control of a state that had always relied in the past on a centralized monarchy, all had come together in a volatile mixture of anger, fear, and uncertainty. Despite writing in the 21st century, Tackett's opinion is shared by many across both time and the ideological spectrum. Historian George Lefebvre, of Marxist orientation and writing in the mid-20th century, is clear in his conviction that circumstances made the massacres possible and that they cannot be attributed to the will of any one individual. Likewise, historian Peter McPhee also focuses on circumstances, in particular, the menace of the counter-revolution and the influence of unpredictable emotions such as panic and fear. However, some historians beg to differ. Instead of seeing a spontaneous tragedy, these scholars see a pre-prepared conspiracy. Historian Gaetano Salvemini, for example, is clear in his belief that these massacres were planned to at least some extent. Joining this 20th century historian is the 19th century historian John Dalberg Acton and the 21st century historian Jonathan Israel. While Israel notes that the documentary evidence for his belief is scarce, he nonetheless argues that the popular tribunals of September were too well organized and the authorities too complicit to call the unrest spontaneous. Israel writes, "While little documentary evidence survives, proving the premeditated complicity of leading Montagnard politicians, and the subsequent widespread talk of their complicity may have been overstated, the atrocities were too organized and the proceedings at the various locations too much of a pattern to have resulted just from spontaneous popular justice." So, one camp of historians thinks all of this was the spontaneous eruption of popular justice, while the other, admittedly smaller camp, is adamant it wasn't spontaneous at all. We need to be mindful of these competing interpretations because as we unpack the perspectives of historians, as well as the accounts of contemporaries, where they fall along this spectrum of spontaneity versus plot is quite important. One last thing before we move on. Within these two schools of thought, there is a tremendous amount of competing ideas, particularly amongst those who believe that the September massacres were spontaneous. You see, it's one thing for historians to agree that the massacres were not orchestrated ahead of time, that they were not deliberately planned. But that doesn't mean that they agree on the causes of that spontaneous eruption in popular justice. It doesn't mean that they agree on who holds accountability for these deaths. And most interestingly, it doesn't mean that they agree on whether or not the authorities deliberately failed to stop the killings once they had started. Just because the murders weren't consciously planned doesn't mean they weren't consciously prolonged. Perhaps they were allowed to continue for a time when the authorities could have intervened, which of course adds some credibility to those historians who see a revolutionary plot of some form. As I said, we're going to be wading through a lot of grey history in this episode, and I think you're going to love it. So, getting back on track, roughly 300 perpetrators were responsible for the bloody days of September, and these men consisted of the capital's most radical revolutionary supporters: Fédéré volunteers from the provinces, National Guardsmen, and radical sans-culottes all participated in the deaths of the city's prisoners. And in fact, many had also participated in the overthrow of the monarchy less than a month prior. Given this small number of 300 or so perpetrators, and given that this was the constituency of the new Paris Commune's political power, to what extent, if any, did the new municipal government play in the deaths? To unpack these questions, the first thing we need to make clear is that members of the commune were involved in the killings. And I choose the word involved deliberately. We'll explore now the debate as to how responsible they may have been for the deaths of the city's prisoners, but at a minimum, commune officials were present at many of the prisons, which saw violent unrest. Furthermore, as we saw with the impromptu trial President Maillard in the last episode, some members of the commune actually acted as judges or played other prominent roles in the popular tribunals, which dispensed the people's justice. Remember, in one of the episode extras for the last episode, we examined the remarkable case of Setmayer's trial, an aristocrat, and his trial was overseen by a commune official. So, given this, how do some historians perceive the commune's actions during the September massacres? And is the involvement of officials proof of an orchestrated plot? Amongst those who oppose the theory that the massacres were orchestrated is historian Timothy Tackett. Tackett dismisses the idea that the commune and its vigilance committee were active instigators of the murders, but notes that the massacres would have had popular support amongst these institutions. In an atmosphere where these public officials believed in a prison conspiracy which endangered the very existence of the revolution, these massacres were conveniently eliminating a key danger for the revolutionary authorities. As a result, Tackett suggests that the murders may have continued longer than they otherwise would have because of the implicit support of those within Town Hall. Officials who saw these massacres as an unexpected but nonetheless advantageous event. Tackett writes, "To be sure, neither the Commune nor the Surveillance Committee directly initiated the massacres, yet it is clear that their members, as so many other elites, had come fully to believe the prison conspiracy rumour and to accept the necessity of eliminating the threat. Their implicit support may well have contributed to the continuation of the massacres after the first 2 days." Having acknowledged the possibility of the Commune's implicit support for the killings which, in their eyes, were eliminating a threat to the revolution, Tackett then offers an explanation as to why so many Commune officials were directly involved in the events of September. Remember that some officials served as the judges for popular tribunals. So how does Tackett reconcile this behaviour with his view that the Commune's support was merely implicit and that it perhaps prolonged the massacres rather than initiated them in the first place? For Tackett, the answer lies in the Commune's intentions. He claims that the municipal officials were sent to control and limit the massacres as best they could, believing they couldn't stop the murders. And perhaps being even unwilling to do so, the Commune did seem genuinely keen to prevent the deaths of those they considered innocent. This included people who were locked up for debts or minor misdemeanors, people who weren't sinister priests or traitorous aristocrats who were out to orchestrate the regime's demise. According to Tackett, as well as many other historians, it's for this reason, for the protection of innocent prisoners, that commune officials could be found playing prominent roles in the massacres of Paris. These officials were there to ensure that only the guilty were put to the sword. Having suggested that many officials implicitly supported the massacres, historian Timothy Tackett continues, "Many commune members did, however, worry that the crowds might kill all of the prisoners indiscriminately. They thus sent delegates to the prisons, not to halt the executions outright, but to organise improvised tribunals and judges to ensure a proper triage between the innocent and the guilty. In several cases, commune representatives remained present during the trials or even served as judges. Those prisoners who had been incarcerated as debtors or for family quarrels, or minor civil infractions were usually freed, as were most of the women. So, according to some historians, the commune did not initiate the massacres, and its officials that were present at the killings weren't so much there to lead them as much as they were there to ensure that the innocent lives were spared. Indeed, we discussed in the last episode how some prisoners were spared, and not just bad debtors, but also former royalists as well. Again, if you haven't listened to the episode extra from the last episode about the trial of the aristocrat Saint-Mihiel, please do so, as you're missing out on an astonishing eyewitness account, and it's accessible to everyone. Now, having said all of this about the actions and intentions of the commune, some historians are just not buying this line of reasoning whatsoever. I mean, when you have commune officials such as Jacques-Nicolas Bayou-Varenne walking around and telling the assailants things like, "You are slaying your enemies, you are doing your duty," well, you can see how some might perceive that to be the exact opposite of a moderating force. Furthermore, while the actions of commune officials are in focus on some occasions, in other circumstances it's the inactions of others which may suggest complicity in the killings. Throughout the murders, the new commander of the National Guard, Santerre, failed to lift much more than a finger in defence of those being slaughtered. Officially, Santerre told the Parisian mayor, Pétion, that while his heart was convulsed with grief, he could not get his orders executed. Unofficially, some see the city guard's new commander as deliberately failing to intervene, allowing other members of the commune to continue to perpetrate what amounts to state-sponsored murder. Furthermore, some of the perpetrators of these crimes were National Guardsmen and Fédérés, the very men who were supposedly loyal to the commune, again lending credibility to those who doubt the municipality's genuine commitment to actually putting a halt to the massacres. Of course, I should point out that this also lends credibility to Santerre's argument that he couldn't get his orders executed. I mean, after all, the men who would execute his orders were the very same ones who were off executing the prisoners. As I said, there's no shortage of ambiguity when it comes to the September massacres. Historian Adolphe Thiers acknowledges that Santerre's letter to Pétion was either a real weakness or duplicity, but it's hard to determine which one. Taken together, the behaviour of some commune officials fuels the conviction of a group of historians and contemporaries who argue that these deaths were planned and orchestrated by the city's municipal government. For example, historian John Dalberg Acton is adamant that the Paris Commune was directly responsible for the deaths, and that any suggestion otherwise is outrageous. By referencing the prominent role of commune officials, as well as reports that they promised to pay the assailants for their good work, historian Dalberg Acton writes forcefully that the massacres were a deliberate and murderous scheme. As this was utterly pointless and unmeaning, it has given currency to the theory that all the horrors of that September were the irrational and spontaneous act of some hundreds of jailbirds, whose eyes were stained with the vision of blood, and who ran riot in their impunity. So that criminal Paris, not revolutionary Paris, was to blame. In reality, the massacres were organised by the Commune, paid for by the Commune, and directed by its emissaries. That last line packs a punch. The massacres were organised by the Commune, paid for by the Commune, and directed by its emissaries. Dalberg Acton's stance is, well, unmistakable. To wrap up, in one camp we have those who view the Commune as innocent of the accusations of a sinister plot. The presence of Commune officials at the prisons can be explained, and the hard evidence of some conspiracy isn't forthcoming. Within this camp, there are some who are open to the idea that the commune may have been complicit in allowing the killings to go on, that it may have encouraged the murders through inaction or implicit support. But repudiating this stance are those who see the commune as guilty of orchestrating a violent conspiracy and point to the prominent involvement or convenient inaction of several officials as proof. This remains a contentious topic, and the role of various commune officials in the popular tribunals muddies the waters significantly. It should be noted that little documentary evidence exists supporting the idea that the commune as a whole was deliberately involved in these deaths. And until more evidence is found, it's hard to see this debate ever being firmly resolved. But having just discussed the complicity of the commune as a whole, as well as the actions of several lesser commune officials, what about those giants of the revolution who were heavily intertwined with the commune? What about Robespierre, who some historians consider to be the king of Town Hall? What about Marat, who had called for the prisoners to be slaughtered en masse just 2 weeks prior? What about Danton, who, as Minister of Justice, wasn't directly a member of the Commune, but nonetheless wielded significant influence there, as well as amongst the revolutionary clubs and sections which supported the municipality? What role did any of these prominent revolutionaries play in the events of September, and can they be held partially responsible for the murders? Let's start with Robespierre. As discussed in previous episodes, Maximilien Robespierre played no significant role in the insurrection of 10 August, but he did join the new municipal government immediately after the Second Revolution. As a member of the new commune, Robespierre wielded considerable influence, with many historians remarking to various degrees just how much power Robespierre exerted over the body. I mean, if Chancellor Palpatine could declare, "I am the Senate," some scholars suggest that Robespierre could reasonably proclaim, "I am the Commune." Okay, that part was a lie. Scholars aren't suggesting that, and, you know, that was definitely my line, but you get my point. Putting the exact extent of Robespierre's influence over the Commune aside, it's because of this considerable influence that Robespierre is a prime person of interest for those historians who believe that the Commune deliberately orchestrated the deaths of the city's inmates. Of course, many historians, perhaps a firm majority, believe that the September massacres were spontaneous. So to be clear, what we're really talking about here is the subset of historians who see these events as revolutionary conspiracy. Perhaps unsurprisingly, many of the historians who see the September massacres as a sinister plot are also detractors of Robespierre. So what we have here is pretty much a uniform attitude of hostility towards one of the most famous and controversial revolutionaries of the time. However, interestingly, this hostility generally does not hold Robespierre responsible so much as it holds him complicit. Historian Gaetano Salvemini, for example, suggests that Robespierre would have seen the massacres as advantageous in relation to intimidating political opponents as elections for the new National Convention commenced. Critically, Salvemini does not suggest that Robespierre was actually involved in any potential plot's development or instigation. Likewise, historian Jonathan Israel, no fan of Robespierre, notes that many of the perpetrators of the murders fell under what he describes as the protective political umbrella of Robespierre's political fiefdom. That is to say, many had strong links to both the Commune and the Montagnard wing of the Jacobin Club. Israel goes on to state that there can be no serious doubt that the September massacres were closely linked to an organised conspiracy, part of a quest for power, both condoned and organised by authoritarian, anti-democratic elements within the Commune. Even still, Israel fails to attribute the organization of this alleged conspiracy to Robespierre himself. So what we're seeing here is that even amongst those historians who believe in conspiracy, Robespierre is generally not regarded as a principal plotter. He might be criticized for failing to use his significant influence to bring a halt to the killings. He might be suspected of seeing the murders as a means for political advantage. But his inaction, and perhaps his implicit support for the deaths, is about the extent that he can be personally held responsible. Again, this is from the perspective of those who see the deaths as a revolutionary plot. There's no shortage of historians who dispute that perspective, and some actively proclaim that Robespierre had no prior knowledge of the murders, nor a hand in their continuation. The respected historian and Robespierre biographer Peter McPhee is adamant that there is no evidence that Robespierre incited or secretly allowed the killings. Interestingly, Robespierre's doctor, retelling the events more than four decades later in the 1840s, was clear in his conviction that the revolutionary figure had never described the events with anything other than horror. So, there's competing ideas as to Robespierre's relationship with the massacres. Some consider him to implicitly support the killings and focus on his use of his influence to later defend the perpetrators. Others consider him to be disgusted by the bloodshed and completely innocent of any links to the murders. But for those who have skipped ahead a little, you'll know that many of Robespierre's contemporaries, specifically his political opponents, would later accuse Robespierre of being partially responsible for the killings. In particular, they would accuse Robespierre of trying to use the massacres as a means of advancing his own political interests. So, what are the origins and evidence behind these accusations? Especially considering that we just heard from historian Peter McPhee, who claimed that there is no evidence to suggest Robespierre was involved in the murders. To explore this, we need to board the magic school bus and go back in time. Specifically, we need to pick up a loose thread from two episodes ago, the cliffhanger of episode 38. At the end of that episode, Robespierre finally made his move against the Girondins. You may recall that on the 2nd of September, Robespierre convinced the Commune to issue arrest warrants for Brissot and several leading Girondins, having accused them of betraying the people and working in collaboration with the Prussian army. Well, the 2nd of September was the same day that all these massacres commenced, which is critically important. While Brissot would not be arrested, thanks to the intervention of the Minister of Justice, Georges Danton, the fact that Robespierre had tried to have Brissot arrested is key. From the perspective of Brissot and his allies, Robespierre had tried to have them murdered. After all, he had tried to have them arrested for treason during a period of time where suspected traitors, oh that's right, were unceremoniously being butchered by a bloodthirsty mob. If former ministers and public officials were being slaughtered by the populace, then what chance would the Girondin deputies have had at their own makeshift trials? Deputies which both Marat and Robespierre had denounced as traitors. Deputies who had strained their relationship with the radical cohorts of Paris due to their timid acceptance of the 10th of August and their initial opposition to the new revolutionary tribunal. In short, the Girondins perceived Robespierre's efforts to have them arrested at the start of the massacres as quite literally an assassination attempt. And I mean, who can blame them? Had they been arrested, there's a damn good chance that they would have been killed. And the only reason they weren't arrested was due to the intervention of the Justice Minister Danton. If Danton hadn't intervened, we could well be talking about a very different revolution from the one we know. Understandably, whatever hope of reconciliation which existed between the two factions of the Jacobin Club, between Brissot's Girondins and Robespierre's Montagnards, died here. In their own eyes, Brissot and his allies had survived a brush with death, and they would never forget it. Historian Timothy Tackett notes, in early September, in the midst of the prison massacres, the Commune's Surveillance Committee searched Brissot's apartment and even issued an arrest warrant for both Brissot and Roland. The Brissotans convinced themselves thereafter that Robespierre had intended to have them murdered in the massacres, and that he and the Commune were the real traitors aligned with foreign enemies. Their supporters spoke of the faction of Marat and Robespierre, who were fomenting chaos to bring down the revolution. It was a plan of destruction and counter-revolution promoted by the paid agents of the émigrés, the Prussians, the Austrians. So, in the case of Robespierre, the conversation is not so much, did he orchestrate the September massacres, so much as it's, did he try to use them to his advantage? Did he seek to use these deaths as a means of influencing the elections for the new convention? Or more importantly, did he try to use these events to eliminate his most potent political rivals? Defending Robespierre's actions is historian Peter McPhee, who passionately rejects the idea that Robespierre attempted to murder Brissot and his allies. Robespierre's opponents sought afterwards to implicate him directly in the killings. The charge is that, once he heard that prisoners judged by self-appointed courts as guilty of being in league with the enemy, no matter how tenuous the connection, were being put to death, he sought to have Brissot and Jean-Marie Roland arrested. The claim was made by Pétion, Louvet, and Manon Roland, who, in the following months, launched an all-out campaign against Robespierre with the purpose of bringing him before the Revolutionary Tribunal. Already by 5 September, Manon Roland was writing to her admirer, Bancal de Essart, claiming that, quoting Madame Roland here, "We are under the knives of Robespierre and Marat." Back to historian Peter McPhee. Sure that the arrest warrants were to deliver her husband and Brissot up to the killers. Only the intervention of Georges Danton, the firebrand Minister of Justice, had stopped the warrants being served. The only supporting evidence for this is that Robespierre had declared that Brissot and Jean-Louis Carrard were aiding the enemy. The latter had suggested that Brunswick or the Duke of York could be a new King of France, and he had obtained warrants from the Commune for the arrest of Brissot and Roland. But this was before the massacres began. According to historian Peter McPhee, Robespierre did not attempt to use the massacres as a means of liquidating his most powerful political opponents. Critically, Robespierre's attempt to have the Brissotans arrested occurred before the massacres commenced, so it can hardly be described as either attempted murder or an attempt to influence the elections to the convention. Of course, contemporaries, particularly the Girondins themselves, would very much disagree with McPhee's assertions. Anyone who knows how this feud ends can see why. In summary, while it's generally agreed that Robespierre himself did not orchestrate the September massacres, his level of complicity and his potential use of the events for his own advantage remain contentious and debated. It remains grey history. Moving on from Robespierre, we find the man who was most often attributed with the responsibility for commencing the September massacres, none other than Jean-Paul Marat. Now, we've already heard from Marat countless times in this series, as he has continuously called for the deaths of hundreds and then thousands of the revolution's enemies. Indeed, we've already heard the radical journalist's appeal for the mass slaughter of the prisoners of Paris. As a reminder, in mid-August, just a couple of weeks before the killings, Marat implored the people of Paris to go armed to the prisons, drag out the traitors, and put them to the sword. Given this call to arms, given his advocacy for revolutionary violence, and given his support of Robespierre's pursuit of the Girondins, well, you can see why he's held responsible by many for inciting and encouraging the massacres, even if he did not mastermind them in some planned conspiracy. Furthermore, Marat's actions as the massacres continued reinforces the perception that he holds responsibility for the events. Most famously, on the 3rd of September, Marat, acting as a member of the Commune's Vigilance Committee, informed the departments of the disturbances in the capital. In this document, he defended the justice dealt to the nation's traitors, and critically, he encouraged the departments to follow the lead of the capital. That is to say, to eliminate their own prisoners before troops departed for the front lines. Now, I've included parts of this quite remarkable document as an episode extra for this episode. But in short, the disturbances of the capital were not limited to Paris. Across France, similar, albeit much smaller, killings did break out across the country in the aftermath of the September massacres. So, if calling for the slaughter of Paris's prisoners wasn't incriminating enough, here's a document encouraging other communes to do the same. Again, you can see why historians and contemporaries across the political spectrum generally hold Marat principally responsible for instigating the September massacres. As perhaps the most popular radical journalist, as an influential member of the revolutionary Cordelier Club, as a member of the Commune, and then as a member of the Commune's Vigilance Committee, Marat used his position and his pen to encourage the very deaths which were now unfolding. But in saying all of this, there are a minority of historians who think Marat is unfairly blamed for these murders. Historian Georges Lefebvre is one of them. Firstly, Lefebvre states that there is no evidence that the document printed by the Vigilance Committee on the 3rd of September actually inspired violence against prisoners in the departments. And as such, Marat cannot be held responsible for any deaths without such evidence. More importantly, however, Lefebvre is adamant that the massacres were instigated by a series of factors and circumstances, and this leaves no place for blame to be held against one man. Lefebvre writes, Marat had many times insisted that the only way to save the revolution was to slaughter the aristocrats en masse. The people's friend, embittered by failure and poverty, by judicial prosecution and illness, attracted an audience because his ominous predictions were being realized and because he demonstrated a keen sense of the sufferings and inarticulate desires harbored by the crowd. Responsibility for the September days has been attributed to him, but the collective mentality that made them possible resulted from circumstances and not from the will of any one particular individual. Joining historian Lefebvre in his defence of Marat is historian Eric Hazen. Now, if historian Lefebvre can be described as a Marxist historian of the mid-20th century, historian Hazen sits fairly close on the political spectrum, although he's writing in the 21st century. Here is Hazen refuting the common blame that is attributed to Marat. There is a common opinion, maintained by many historians, including Jaurès, who could not find words harsh enough for this theorist of systematic murder, that Marat had called for the massacres and bore sole responsibility for it. This view is based on an article in The Friend of the People on 19 August, in which Marat wrote, now quoting Marat, "The final option, which is the safest and most wise, is to proceed armed to the Abbaye, seize the traitors, particularly the Swiss officers, and their accomplices and put them to the sword. Back to historian Eric Hazen. Between 19 August and 2 September, however, Marat published nothing, for the good reason that his paper did not appear in this interval, and it is hard to see people suddenly rushing to the prisons on the basis of an article 2 weeks old. So, to recap, most historians and contemporaries look to Marat, at least in part, when assigning blame for the massacres. Despite the defences we just heard, some socialist historians, as well as those who believe the massacres were spontaneous, assign some level of responsibility to the famous revolutionary, arguing that it was his words, his publications, his advocacy for popular violence, which helped to create and subsequently foster the environment required for such an event to take place. However, a minority of historians disagree, and of course, so did Marat himself. Weeks after the massacre, on the 14th of October, 1792, Marat denounced accusations against him and Robespierre as the slander used by rogues who sought to paint the Commune of Paris as a horde of cannibals. He blamed this slander on the Girondins. And indeed, we will get to the role of the Girondins in all of this and how they tried to weaponize these deaths against leading revolutionaries. Nonetheless, when discussing the September massacres, many historians from across the ideological spectrum will point to Marat as one of, if not the chief instigators of the bloodshed. He may not have planned the deaths, but many argue he did inspire them, or at a minimum, he contributed to the atmosphere which enabled the river of blood. To wrap up, I have included my own personal views on this topic of Marat's specific level of responsibility in the episode extra for this episode. The episode extra will unpack that document Marat sends to the departments, encouraging them to follow the lead of the capital, as well as further explore historian Lefebvre's claims that it had no impact. I'll also be refuting historian Hazen's claim that Marat's light publication schedule prevents him from being inspiration for the murders, and thus holding some sort of accountability for these events. Now, having covered the Commune, as well as its key members Robespierre and Marat, let us move away from the town hall and towards the other institutions of the government, namely the new Executive Council, aka the Ministry, as well as the Legislative Assembly, which supported it. Of particular note here are the roles of Danton as the Minister of Justice, as well as Roland and Brissot as the two leading members of the Girondin faction. Let's start with Danton. The discussions surrounding Danton in relation to the September massacres are different again from those surrounding Robespierre and Marat. For Robespierre, the principal focus relates to what, if any, extent did he seek to use the massacres for his own political advantage. For Marat, the principal focus relates to what extent he can be held responsible for instigating and then fueling the murders. For Danton, the principal focus is whether or not he failed to do enough to try to stop the killings. Whether he, as the Minister of Justice, allowed the massacres to continue despite having an ability to put them to an end. Another focus is if he, like Marat, helped to instigate the murders through provocative and violent speech, but we'll get to that later. Let's focus first on Danton's actions in relation to bringing the massacres to an end. Perhaps Danton's most infamous part in the September days occurs from a retelling that is detailed by Madame Roland, the influential wife of the Interior Minister. In an iconic scene, Danton is supposed to have been approached by a prison inspector who was seeking to secure the well-being of the city's prisoners. According to Madame Roland, who we should take with a grain of salt here, given her alignment with the Girondin faction, Danton dismissed these concerns forcefully. Famously, he's alleged to have proclaimed, "I don't give a damn for the prisoners. Let them look after themselves as best they can. Given this infamous stance from Danton, it's understandable why there is so much focus on why he seemed unwilling to assertively end the violence. This stance is also contradictory to the positions he had taken in August, when the minister had helped Swiss guards escape the wrath of the populace on 10 August. Indeed, Danton had subsequently advocated for mercy for those Swiss who had survived. Furthermore, we know Danton personally intervened to quash the arrest warrants of Brissot, Roland, and other Girondins, and he also intervened for prominent Fillons as well, including the former deputies Adrien Duport and Charles Lemaitre. If Danton was willing to save some citizens, specifically high-profile politicians, which was sought after by their enemies in the new regime, why was he so dismissive of efforts to stop the killings altogether? Why did he proclaim he didn't give a damn? One theory relates to the war effort. Although Justice Minister, Danton had come to dominate much of the Executive Council, which had replaced the King in the aftermath of the 10th of August. In many ways, matters of foreign affairs and the military were influenced by him, despite not being the associated minister. And by the start of September, he was singularly focused on stopping the Prussian advance. Historian Gaetano Salvemini argues that Danton failed to stop the massacres, in part because the justice minister saw benefits for the war effort. The deaths in Paris put a river of blood between the Parisians and the Prussians, to paraphrase Danton's own words, and this river allowed the Parisians to cross the proverbial Rubicon. You see, after the massacres, there would be no going back. There would be no backsliding, no possibility for rapprochement or reconciliation. The Prussians had already promised to burn Paris to the ground in the infamous Brunswick Manifesto should the inhabitants misbehave. And well, since then, the Parisians had been very, very naughty. They had not only toppled the monarchy through violent revolution, but they had now systematically executed priests, aristocrats, royalist sympathisers, hell, even a foreign princess had been butchered and beheaded. In a sense, like Robespierre, Salvemini argues that Danton may have seen the massacres as an opportunity to advance his own agenda. In this case, the defence of the capital and the empowerment of the war effort. Salvemini writes, "A massacre of the prisoners, therefore, might be useful in placing a river of blood between the people of Paris and the émigrés. It would render any backsliding on the part of the timid impossible, and give mastery over the capital to those who were not merely disposed, but forced to fight to their last breath." This perception is shared by historian Robert Johnson. In fact, Johnson goes further, arguing that Danton believed the government to be too weak to save the revolution. To elaborate, Johnson believes that Danton indulged the vengeance and cruelty of the people, his words, not mine, as a means of strengthening the war effort by further radicalizing the revolution. These events would tie the people closer to the new revolutionary government, align their fates in the face of the Prussian advance, and silence internal dissent. Put simply, this perspective argues Danton failed to intervene because intervention was not in the interests of the national defence. However, both of these points of view imply that Danton could have stopped the murders had he chosen to do so. To be clear, many historians blame Danton for the massacre's continuation because they firmly believe that the popular and influential justice minister could have intervened. But what if that's not the case? Historian Salvemini notes that Danton did not control the armed forces. The National Guard were under the command of the Commune. Or at least nominally they were, Remember that the commander of the National Guard, Santerre, was claiming the contentious excuse that no one would obey his command. In such a situation, Salvemini argues that Danton was not necessarily in a position to be able to stop the murders. I mean, who would listen to him? The people in charge of keeping order? The city's militia? And the volunteers from the provinces? Well, they were the very people conducting the massacres. The sans-culottes, who respected Danton for his leadership of the radical Cordelier Club? Well, they too had their hands covered in blood. In fact, considering that the vast majority of Paris's inhabitants were hardly rushing out to stop the incredibly small number of assailants, Danton could hardly rely on their support to stop the killings as well. In short, there's potentially an argument, although contentious, that Danton wasn't in a position to bring these killings to a halt. But muddying the waters further, Salvemini then suggests that Danton couldn't afford to stop the killings, even if he had the men at his disposal to do so. Above all else, Danton's priority was the Prussian invasion. It was the conflict with the Prussians, not the prisoners, that demanded his attention. What the nation needed was unity in the face of these foreign invaders. Unity between the assembly, the commune, and the ministry. The easiest way to secure that unity was to allow the murders to continue. To do otherwise would have pinned the ministry and the assembly against the revolutionary cohorts of Paris, against the National Guard, the Fédéré volunteers, the sans-culottes, and potentially even the Commune, which all three groups supported. To do anything other than permit the massacres to continue may have extinguished the revolutionary fervour and zeal which was so desperately required to successfully expel the advancing Prussians, which had been so critical in toppling the monarchy and would be so critical to the existence of the regime which replaced it. To do anything else, as historian Peter Kropotkin states, would be to invite civil war in the capital. Danton may have held sympathies for the prisoners, but if saving the prisoners meant jeopardizing the war effort, well, that was not a price he would have been willing to pay. On a personal and more cynical note, historian Christopher Hibbert also remarks that Danton may not have wished to attempt to stop the massacres because it could have jeopardized his standings with the sans-culottes. What would have been the point of sacrificing his hard-won popularity, and in a sense, his power, if he believed that there was a good chance that the massacres would continue, even with his intervention? Better to save the lives of a select few and maintain his influence than risk it all, especially for prisoners that, although innocent of treason, could offer little in Danton's efforts to save the nation. To go on a tangent for a brief moment, a similar line of reasoning could also explain the reluctance to act from some members of the Paris Commune. Remember, the new Commune owed its existence thanks to its support amongst the revolutionary sections of Paris, along with the radical sans-culottes, National Guardsmen, and Fédéré volunteers. Well, some sections were passing motions to eliminate the prisoners, while some radical sans-culottes, National Guardsmen, and Fédéré volunteers were the ones actually doing the eliminating. Putting aside the debate as to whether or not the Commune could command a force to intervene, doing so would have directly contradicted the desires of the Commune's power base. Surrounded by enemies, conflict with the very people keeping them in power was probably not great for the chances of the new Commune's survival. Thus, just like Danton, there is an argument to be made that perhaps some in the Commune were unwilling to attempt to stop the will of the people if it jeopardized the institution's position of power. Getting back on track, it seems to always be the case that with Danton, his exact motivations and actions are ambiguous. Some argue his inaction was a result of being distracted by the war effort, while others see the war effort as the reason for deliberate inaction. Some believe that the minister could have intervened in the deaths should he have chosen to do so, but others argue that Danton was unwilling to intervene because either he knew that any intervention had a slim chance of succeeding, or because disunity could help the Prussian advance. Before we go on, it is worth noting that, like Robespierre and Marat, Danton's reputation will be tarnished by these events. This will be reinforced by the fact that he, like Robespierre and Marat, will defend the massacres. As a result, the murders of September will be used as a weapon against him by his political opponents in the future. Interestingly, some argue that, like Marat, Danton's words helped to create the environment in which these killings could occur. So, before we move on, let's quickly examine why some people have argued that Danton's words instigated the massacres themselves. As historian Jeremy Popkin notes, in Danton's speeches leading up to the murders, it can be said that Danton created an atmosphere in which extreme measures seemed justified. Not only had he repeatedly called for daring and bold measures, but critically, on the 2nd of September, he also stated that the government called upon all citizens to put to death anyone who refused to give personal service or to furnish arms in defence of the nation. I'll say that again. Danton, speaking on behalf of the government, called upon all citizens to put to death anyone who refused to give personal service or to furnish arms in defence of the nation. Obviously, the prisoners of Paris fell into this category. Not only were they refusing to give personal service or to furnish arms, but according to the rumours, they were actively conspiring with the enemy themselves. As a result, Danton's call for all objectors to be put to death on the day that the massacres commenced, and on the day that news of Verdun's imminent capitulation reached Paris, fuels an argument that Danton's words directly encouraged, perhaps even triggered, the massacres. At a minimum, many historians argue that they contributed to the acceptance of popular violence as a legitimate means to save the revolution. Now, to be clear, Danton's words were a far cry from Marat's. Remember, Marat was explicitly demanding that the prisoners be put to the sword, along with anyone who was hampering that outcome, including elected officials. That's part of the reason why Marat has a unique position as the person most often associated with and blamed for the massacres. But Danton's calls were unmistakably violent, and unlike Marat's, they actually occurred on the day the massacres started. Thus, Danton's detractors, including his contemporary political opponents, would accuse both Marat and Danton of being septembriseurs, men whose violent and homicidal words instigated the horrors of the September days. While there is no evidence to suggest that he planned or instigated the murders, one can make the case that he too helped to create the atmosphere and environment which was required for them to succeed. Furthermore, his actions in relation to potentially allowing them to continue, as well as any motivations for deliberate inaction, will continue to remain surrounded in debate and ambiguity. In short, if you want to hold Danton partially responsible for the events of September, well, there's no shortage of ways to make that argument. Likewise, if you want to defend Danton's actions during the September days, you've got plenty of material to work with as well. Hello, everybody. This is a quick ad for Grey History. I desperately need your help to keep Grey History on the air. I've left my job. I've thrown caution to the wind. I'm giving everything I can to bring you more Grey History more often, but I need your help to keep going. Please spread the word about Grey History and please support the show on Patreon. Patreon even comes with an ad-free feed, so there's no mid-show interruptions. Plus, there's all those hours of exclusive bonus content. So please, if you're enjoying Grey History, help keep it going and support the show today. Thanks for listening, and back to the episode. Finally, we turn our attention to the Girondins. As a reminder, the Girondin faction at this point in time commanded essentially a majority in the Legislative Assembly, which of course was based in Paris. Likewise, ministers linked to the Girondins made up a majority of the new Executive Council, which had replaced the king. But as previously noted, the new ministry was unexpectedly dominated by Danton, who was not a Girondin. Given the position of Brissot in the Assembly and the Interior Minister Roland in the Executive Council, what did the Girondins get up to during these dark days of September? To start with, let's just emphatically make clear that no one blames the Girondins for some sort of sinister plot to try to deliberately eliminate the prisoners of Paris. While many Girondins may well have believed in the rumours surrounding the prisons, this was the faction which had resisted calls to establish the new revolutionary tribunal in mid-August. The Girondins were not about to adopt a covert scheme to deliberately and systematically eliminate those under the protection of the state. So the discussions here relates to a few things. Firstly, did senior figures do enough to try to stop the killings? Secondly, did prominent Girondins excuse or justify the murders, just like some prominent Montagnard revolutionaries did? And finally, and this is where things get really interesting, are the Girondins just giant hypocrites when it comes to the bloody events of September? Let's start with the first issue at hand. Did the Girondins do enough to stop the murders? If we examine the actions of the Legislative Assembly, we can say the body contributed absolutely zilch to the ending of the massacres. The Assembly failed to act in any sort of meaningful way, and the reasons for this inaction are debated. Similar to the discussions surrounding both the Commune and Danton, some historians argue that the Assembly was distracted, focused primarily on the war effort and the advancing Prussian army. Others suggest that the body was not in a position to actually intervene, having lost most of its authority to the new Commune and commanding no loyalty from a sufficiently armed force to actually halt the perpetrators. Finally, it's reasonable to suggest that at least part of the Assembly may well have believed in the prison conspiracies, and thus, like members of the Commune, they were perhaps not in such an immediate rush to put an end to the killings. So, just why the Assembly was inactive is disputed, but inactive it was. With the few delegations they sent out proving to be utterly useless in stopping the murders, and in fact being threatened by the crowd, the deputies of the Assembly promptly decided to just keep out of it. However, the actions of specific Girondins are a little different and more contentious. If we start with the Interior Minister Roland, historian Adolphe Thiers goes to great lengths to demonstrate how the minister worked overtime to halt the massacres. In contrast to his colleague Danton, Roland actively sought to bring the killings to an end, at least according to historian Adolphe Thiers. Historian Gaetano Salvemini disagrees, arguing that Roland's actions amounted to little, as did those of the mayor, Jerome Pétion. Salvemini essentially argues that the actions of both men were ineffectual and unremarkable, summarising briefly that the combined efforts of the Minister of the Interior and the Mayor of Paris amounted merely to this polite exchange of views. The perception that Roland and Pétion failed to act is supported by some contemporaries, although the evidence is admittedly self-serving. For example, Charlotte Robespierre later claimed that her brother fell out with Pétion because Robespierre thought the mayor had failed to do enough to curtail the killings. An interesting fact, yes, but I'm also not surprised that Charlotte may have thrown some shade on a future adversary of the family, particularly on the topic of one of the revolution's most bloodiest and contentious events. As a quick aside, I would like to point out that while we generally associate Mayor Pétion with the Girondins, at this point of time, the very popular mayor of Paris was not strictly grouped with those deputies. As a former deputy of the National Assembly, Pétion had deep connections within the Jacobin Club. He considered himself a friend of Robespierre, and it's not until he's a member of the new convention that we start to see him associate far more exclusively with the Girondins. Nonetheless, that transition is definitely starting to happen. In fact, it's underway, so be prepared to hear the name of Pétion far more frequently alongside other Girondins like Brissot, Roland, and Vernieu. Getting back on track, like the Commune and like Danton, the Girondins of Paris, both in the Assembly and outside of it, did little to effectively stop the massacres. Why this was the case is disputed, but everything from ineptitude to the distraction of the war effort feature as possible answers. So far, nothing particularly noteworthy. But when discussing the Girondins and the September massacres, we do come across a rather controversial topic, and that is to say, the potential hypocrisy of this faction. As we've already discussed, the Girondins would later use these violent and bloody days as weapons against their political opponents, most notably those associated with the Montagnard faction of the Jacobins. As factional hostilities grip the new convention, the chief targets of these attacks will eventually include Robespierre, Marat, and Danton. Seeking to gain mastery of the new legislature, the attacks against these men will be frequent and brutal, and the Girondins aimed to use these dark days to discredit their opponents and advance their own position. Now, we're going to see all of this in future episodes, so I want to focus on the fierce criticism that some historians level against the Girondins for these actions. Because ultimately, depending on one's point of view, the Girondins may be giant hypocrites. Before we wrap up this episode, let's explore one last can of worms. In the immediate aftermath of the September massacres, even during the events itself, the buzzword of the week was necessity. An awful necessity. An unfortunate necessity. A terrible necessity. But a necessity nonetheless. Over time, the idea that the massacres were necessary, and the idea that they were a genuine expression of the people's will, came to be a means of defending, even legitimizing the events. Indeed, Marat, Robespierre, and Danton would all at various points in time defend the murders. Critically, however, as blood was being spilt on the streets of Paris, the Girondins sung from the same songbook. At least, initially. You see, during the massacres themselves, some, and I emphasize some Girondins, used their newspapers and journals to either support the killings or say nothing. Gossard, for example, reported on the 3rd of September that the massacres were a terrible justice, but necessary. 2 days later, on the 5th, Carrar assured his readers that the innocent have been spared. All those who have been slaughtered had given well-known proof of lack of civic virtue, and perhaps that is a crime worthy of death at a time when the homeland must be saved. Most famously, the Interior Minister Roland, one of the most influential Girondins, stated that a veil must be thrown on the events. Considering the corpses numbered more than 1,000, the veil would have to be considerable to hide what had occurred. In short, some Girondins, although not all, did implicitly support the massacres through their silence, or even explicitly defended the murders through either their advocacy or justifications. So, given that some of the Girondins described the massacres as necessary, and given that others remained relatively silent, how can we reconcile this with their eventual use of these massacres just weeks later as a weapon against their political opponents? The answer depends on who you ask. Some historians and contemporaries see nothing more than blatant hypocrisy. They see the use of these murders as a means to diminish the authority, the prestige, and most importantly, the power of the Mountain. In particular, this meant Marat, Danton, and the Girondins' chief nemesis, Robespierre. From this perspective, the Girondins were watching their power and influence slip away. They were watching their hold on the radical cohorts of Paris diminish over time, as the Montagnards had consistently aligned themselves to the demands of the people. It was members of the Montagnards, as well as like-minded associates, such as those in the Cordelier Club and the Parisian sections, which had championed the radical cause of the city's revolutionary cohorts. It was they which had pushed for universal male suffrage, which had overturned the monarchy, which had established a new commune, which had demanded the revolutionary tribunal. The Montagnards and those aligned with them were ascendant, and the Girondins needed to reverse the trend. If they could use the gruesome deaths of September to discredit their political opponents, if they could use the subsequent reaction in favour of moderation to empower themselves, then they would do exactly that. In short, some see the Girondins as opportunistic hypocrites, supporting the massacres one moment, weaponizing them the next. And in fact, opportunistic hypocrites is the sort of label that is regularly applied to these Republicans, who of course defended and secretly collaborated with the monarchy when it suited their interests. Remember that the Girondins secretly commenced negotiations with the court, and in fact defended the crown in the final weeks before the fall of the monarchy. In the eyes of their detractors, the words Girondins and hypocrites were one and the same. However, others do not share such a negative view of the actions of the Girondin faction. Historian Marisa Linton argues that the Girondins became hostile to the massacres once they came to believe that Robespierre had orchestrated a plot to use them as a means of having them murdered. If so, well, one can see how the prospect of your own death may change one's perspective on a particular event. Historian Michael Sydenham offers an alternative point of view, but defends the Girondins nonetheless. According to Sydenham, many Girondins were hesitant to praise the murders, even when they thought them to be focused exclusively on genuine traitors. Sydenham asserts that an undertone of revulsion and repugnance can be detected within the statements of leading Girondins, and notes that while the deaths were ongoing, some Girondins were calling for their immediate end. So, once it became clear that so many innocents had perished, and once the danger had passed to their own personal safety, it's not so surprising that the Girondins condemned these events in force. Sydenham makes the case that their failure to immediately attack the massacres does not make the Girondins' repudiation of the events any less genuine. This reading of their attitude is not nullified by the fact that they expressed much more horror later when they tried to saddle the Jacobins with responsibility for the atrocities than they did at the beginning of September. The limited evidence that is available certainly suggests that their first reaction was one of acquiescence or even approval. On 3 September, Roland, in a famous phrase, advised the assembly to draw a veil over what had happened, since the people tempered its vengeance with a kind of rough justice, and Condorcet reserved his judgment in almost identical terms. But even in these expressions, made when it was thought that only traitors were being slain, an undertone of revulsion is apparent, and this, the continuity and extent of the massacres, and the discovery that many innocent people had perished, certainly enhanced. In his speech on 3 September, Rolon called upon the newly reconstituted municipal authorities to prevent further excesses, and 10 days later, he made his attitude still clearer. Now quoting Rolon, "I did not hastily condemn the terrible initial upheaval. I did believe that its continuation had to be avoided." Back to Sydenham. The massacres placed in the hands of all who opposed the commune and, at a later date, the Mountain, a powerful weapon with which to attack their adversaries. They used it to the full, but their exaggerations are quite compatible with a fundamental sincerity. Fear, ignorance, and the consciousness of their own impotence combined to make acquiescence expedient during the disorders. But the lapse of time and the prestige of a new parliament gave men confidence to condemn. So, according to historian Michael Sydenham, the Girondins aren't so much shameless hypocrites, so much as their position is often oversimplified or misunderstood by their detractors. The calm after the massacres allowed some Girondins to articulate a point of view that they had held from the beginning. From this perspective, the Girondins, or at least most Girondins, had never enthusiastically embraced the massacres, unlike some in the Commune and the Montagnard wing of the Jacobin Club. Instead, many Girondins had reluctantly gone along with things. At a time when traitors were being put to the sword, at a time when the Commune sought some of their own arrests, their survival required silence and appeasement. As the excesses of the September days became clear, as Robespierre's attempts to arrest some of the leading Girondins became known, as order was restored in the capital, and the threats of both revolutionary and counter-revolutionary violence receded, these factors encouraged the Girondins to take a much firmer, much stronger stance. Furthermore, it allowed them to go on the attack against the men they held responsible for September, men who, unlike themselves, would not denounce the massacres. This perspective perhaps dilutes some of the initial support that some Girondins definitely did lend the massacres, but the alternative perspective also misses nuance. For example, in all the criticism of the Girondin hypocrisy, it's often lost that Brissot, one of the most influential Girondins, did use his publication to immediately and unreservedly denounce the atrocities. Thus, for at least one of the most prominent members of the faction, there was no change in their position. Likewise, despite Rolon's line that a veil must be thrown over the event, a line so often used to attack the minister and suggest implicit support for the murders, Rolon immediately called for the massacres to be stopped. In fact, Rolon warned that genuine traitors could abuse the indignation of the people to serve their own ends, and stated clearly that the authorities had to bring a halt to the massacres without delay. Acknowledging that his calls would enrage some of the perpetrators, Rolon's words were not exactly those of someone who was unreservedly supporting the people's justice. Finally, when we're talking about all the factions of the revolution, but particularly the Girondins, we need to keep in mind that there are risks and impracticalities in talking about these groups as one homogeneous entity. This is a group of people where some historians think the word faction is too strong a word, and it's better to describe them as a loose group of friends and like-minded individuals. Seldom is there complete unity in modern-day political parties, and we are so far off the structures and discipline of modern-day parties, it's not even funny. All of these factors muddy the waters, and the blatant hypocrisy of the Girondins certainly becomes a little less blatant, to say the least. In short, just like the positions of pretty much every other individual, faction, and institution that we've discussed in this episode, the actions, motivations, and opinions of the Girondins remains disputed. Going forward, however, prepare to see them use these massacres as a weapon against their Montagnard opponents in the convention. All in all, the perspectives and opinions of the September massacres are numerous, to say the least. Some believe that the speeches of Marat and Danton are critical in instigating the murders, while others focus on circumstances and events, repudiating the idea that the words of one man can be blamed for the slaughter. Some focus on how Robespierre and Danton sought to use the massacres to advance their own agendas, personal or otherwise, while others refute that such cynical and Machiavellian plots were even a possibility. The role of the Commune is covered in doubt, thanks to the participation of many lesser Commune officials in the killings themselves. And while the inaction of the Assembly is a little clearer, its own motivations remain subject to debate. Not even the Girondins escape questions. They didn't start the massacres, that much is clear, but did they do enough to stop them? And did they seek to use them as weapons in a hypocritical and duplicitous manner? Put simply, pretty much everyone connected to the massacres would walk away shrouded in some form of contentious debate. And the reason for this, well, it's pretty simple. These massacres matter. This incredibly bloody, incredibly gruesome event will fundamentally shape the character, the trajectory, even the very nature of the revolution. This here is a pivotal moment towards the Reign of Terror, towards the Republic, towards a quarter of a century of conflict, towards the modern world. It's here that the Parisians created a river of blood, and it's here that they proceeded to cross the Rubicon. The armies of the coalition were not prepared for what came next. Thank you for listening to episode 40, The September Massacres, part 2. The next episode will be the final part of our exploration of the September massacres, examining how ordinary citizens responded to the bloody and violent events. The responses of some contemporaries may very well surprise you. We'll also examine the effects of the massacres, because they do help to fundamentally change the course, the trajectory, and even the very character of the French Revolution. In the episode extra for this episode, we'll be examining historian Lefebvre and historian Hazen's defence of Jean-Paul Marat. I'll be unpacking Lefebvre's claim that there is no evidence that Marat's cries for slaughter were heeded by the departments, and I'll be refuting the claims of Hazen that Marat cannot be held partially accountable for the violence. As always, a huge thank you to everyone supporting the show, with a special call out to the new Patreons of Grey History and the extra generous heroes of the revolution, Brian, Jinx, Eric, and Christy. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. Please, please, please tell your friends about the show. And as always, have a great day.